Hello, welcome to Phoenix Cinema.
It's good to be back.
Oh, you've been here before then?
Many times.
Well, welcome back.
I appreciate it, thank you.
What movie will it be for you today?
You know what? Surprise me.
Okay, that's one surprise ticket for...
Dexter?
Enjoy the movie, Dexter.
Thank you.
Welcome to a very special episode of Phoenix Cinema Podcast. I'm Chris Austin.
And I'm Luke Barker.
And the reason this is a very special episode is because we have a very special guest. And that guest is the actor in films such as Lock, Stock and Two Smoking Barrels, Layer Cake and HBO's Band of Brothers, as well as the director of films such as Eddie the Eagle, Rocket Man, and most recently Ghosted. And that man is Dexter Fletcher. Dexter, thank
Hello.
You so much for joining us. Welcome.
More than welcome. I'm happy to be here. Thanks very much.
Thank you. Well, this is a truly exciting episode for us because this is the first time we've had someone of your caliber, so to speak,
and, okay.
and level okay. of experience join us for a chat. And so we're pumped. That
Great.
You're here.
I'm honoured. Good. Thank you very much.
And the reason Likewise. You're here is because, well, thank you. We have a mutual acquaintance, Kim Robbins.
Yeah.
Shout out to Kim.
Yeah, hi, Kim.
Put us in touch because you used to frequent the Phoenix Cinema, is that correct?
It wasn't unknown in my teenage years yet and my formative years that I would frequent the Phoenix. I used to go to school in Muswell Hill, which is not far from you guys, and live in Bounds Green, which is a little bit further. But my elder brother, Graham, who was also in the film industry, was certainly a fan of the late nights there. And we would come along and see films there back in the day. We could still smoke in the Phoenix that long ago. I'm talking 40 years ago. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Mm. Wow. Yeah. Amazing.
Well, the cinema has changed a lot and is even changing even more now. It's actually closed at the moment for restoration.
They're
opening,
oh, is it?
Opening another screen, I believe.
Second screen.
Yeah.
Really?
Yes.
So does that mean the main screen's going to get smaller? I mean, what do you do? Your footprint can't get any larger, presumably.
So I think the main screen stays the same. And then, that whole bar area just opposite
yes.
it? That, somehow, they're refurbishing that whole area and putting a second screen there. So that's going to be the smaller screen, I think.
Wow. I'd love to see that.
Yeah. Yeah, same. Yeah, I can't wait
fantastic.
To see that.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, look, like I say, it's been 40 years, maybe more since I've been there. And so that's why I was kind of interested to talk to you guys, keep the talk, because you could, you know, bring me up to date and up to speed on what's happening and where things are at and on what to expect next time I get there, which will be soon, I hope.
Absolutely. Well, I hope so too. Yeah, I hope so too. Was there... In all the years ago that you went there, do you remember, was there any film you remember seeing at the Phoenix that you particularly enjoyed that stuck with you?
Tin Drum. I remember seeing Tin Drum there when it first came out because you couldn't see it everywhere. It wasn't a wide release on Tin Drum. And it was one of those films that we went and had a late night and sat and watched and smoked and watched Tin Drum. But I remember thinking how amazing that was. So that made quite an impact. But there used to be double bills as well, I remember. I think there was a film called Welcome to the Ritz, which was a film set in a bathhouse in New York, in Manhattan, that was quite an interesting, crazy film. I think it was called The Ritz, something like that. I don't know, it was just really wild about all these gay men in a steam baths in Manhattan. I wonder what happened to that film. It was very funny. I think there was a double bill of maybe Animal House and The Jerk.
Oh, God, yes.
That maybe I went and saw there, which was quite a double bill. Would they do double bills back in the day at the late nights? I wonder. You must have all of this logged, don't you? You must have all the access to the archives of what was screened and what was not.
I wish we had that. Oh, I wish. No. I mean, maybe I could ask. Yeah, but that would be excellent. Mm.
Is there some old usher still working there from back in the yeah. war, just after the war?
Cliff, oh, yeah. Who has all the
yeah, exactly. French lieutenant's woman. Yeah, I remember yeah. that was on with Ryan's daughter. Yeah, that was on as well.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah, there was a few late. Look, we used to go there because, like I say, you could smoke there, and we'd, you know, we'd sneak in a joint and smoke a joint up the back and all that kind of nefarious stuff that you do when you're a teenager. But the Phoenix was always programmed. But it was sort of in akin to like going to the Scala cinema. When the Scala cinema, which is the nightclub in King's Cross now, but that used to be in a place called Scala Street. It was started by Steve Woolley. That again was this kind of art house cinema where you could go and see stuff that didn't get wide release at all.
Right.
And the great Rock and Roll Swindle and, you know, the Creature from the Black Lagoon, you know, stuff that didn't get screened anymore. You could go and see. And so going to the Phoenix was kind of like the late nights, particularly were akin to, you know, those more subversive and kind of off the beaten track choices that you could go on a Friday night and be there till 4 in the morning watching stuff. Which,
oh, that's amazing. You know, for a completely different flavour, yeah. Well, as I say, the Tin Drum, I think Criterion released that recently. I say recently, maybe a year or two ago. It's Volker something.
Volker, yes. Yeah.
I've never seen it myself,
Oh, you've got to see it. It's an insane film. It's great, yeah. Because he's got this kid who could, I think he can scream and break glasses and stuff and, from what I remember, it's a very intense film. I think I might have eaten some magic mushrooms, so it might have somewhat. It was about the only time in my life I ever did that. But yeah, it was certainly at the Phoenix. That's for sure.
100%. Incredible, yeah. Incredible.
Don't quote me on that, but anyway, like I say, 40 years ago.
So even back then, who were your touchstone inspirations growing up back then? Actors, directors. Anyone specifically?
I suppose so. Yeah, I mean, I used to love Mike Lee back in the day, and certainly spent a lot of time watching him. I don't know if I ever saw a film of his at the Phoenix because they were usually BBC films. But Pacino was a fairly strong favourite back then. 40 years ago, it was around the Scarface days.
Mm.
I'm trying to think. Kurt Russell, Big Trouble in Little China, stuff like that. We used to really
watch that just the other day. Excellent.
Gosh, amazing. Great
it's
film.
It's bonkers,
like,
yeah.
Yeah, but it's like, I don't know if they'd make that now, but it was phenomenal.
Well, I heard they were doing a remake of that, but I don't know what's happening with that.
Doing a remake of Running Man as well. Doesn't necessarily mean it's a good idea. I mean, look, they've got a good director, so that's something, but that's the sort of stuff we'd see as well. It was like Running Man, Terminator. I remember going to see Terminator at a cinema. And that was like a matinee, and I had no idea what I was going to see. I was on my own, and I was working at a theatre, and the theatre that had an agreement with the local cinema, and the actors could go and see a matinee for free. So I was like, I wandered up and had a ticket for a matinee. It said the Terminator. I had no idea, and sat back and was like, "Oh my god, yeah. what have I just seen?" That was
I wish I could.
But you imagine walking into Terminator, but no idea.
No
what it
idea.
Was about. not a clue. Arnold wasn't anybody. You know,
Cameron wasn't anybody. Yeah,
Cameron wasn't anybody. The title didn't mean anything.
Right.
You know, it was like, but I remember again seeing The Jerk in the cinema, and that was a pretty surreal experience. An Animal House, and these are the films that I'm trying to think what else we'd get out and see. Convoy, Saturday Night Fever. This was all that period back in the 70s and 80s, you know. So I suppose it was all those guys, and you know, you get to see the Wild Bunch on telly. That's late night TV was like when films came around on TV that had a release, but films would get like a release. you know, they come back round again in the, in the cinema, you know, so they sort of get released 1 year and then next year you go, all right, I'll catch it on the next time round. Jaws, King Kong with Jessica Lange in it. And I'm just thinking about all the films I went and saw back in the day. These are incredible, epic films. Superman was all over the place. Going to see Superman was like, that was amazing with Christopher Reeves.
Would you say that, like, all these films you just mentioned, would you say that, like, at all they've had any particular influence, or would they, like, shaped your own approach to filmmaking, whether, like, as an actor or a director at all?
I suppose they must do, whether it's, you know, that's the thing I've learned over my 50-odd years, is that, you know, if you love film, you're kind of absorbing it from every angle, and then that's good, bad, and otherwise, you know, the stuff that you're indifferent about, the stuff that you love, the stuff that you can't bear, you know, you kind of, you have to ask yourself those questions why you don't like it. That's what really sort of starts answering the questions about who you are and what you like, and you know, because it's all subjective. And but I suppose the scale of those films, when I think about, you know, the King Kong, for example, I remember making a big impression on me, or the Poseidon Adventure. These films had kind of scale and big stars in them, and were big sort of, it was the disaster movie eerie. The Tower and Inferno was fucking super intense. Going to see that in the cinema. An Earthquake was like, can you imagine seeing that in the cinema when you're like, you know, 9 years old? Like, these films are amazing. And it had like Steve McQueen and Paul Newman in it, and Fred Astaire, and amongst many others, you know, Robert Vaughn. And so I suppose there's that kind of big, largesse kind of filmmaking flavour to that. I don't know how they stand up in terms of scale, because of course there wasn't massive visual effects and CGI going on, but they did feel big, and I suppose that's part of the cinema going experience, is that, you know, you feel this scale, you know, you got the whir of the projector, and you can hear the film going through the, you know, through the projector, and reels being changed, and little flashes up in the top right hand corner circles change the reel, and all those things, if you know what they mean. It's kind of like you kind of miss all that stuff.
Well, that kind of leads perfectly onto, like, something else I wanted to touch on was, do you think that kind of, like, maybe this move to streaming is means people are, like, missing out on that experience?
It's certainly to a degree. I mean, it's sort of like, it becomes, I don't know, more of a purist form, doesn't it? I mean, look, the thing is, what I'm encouraged by, you know, the theatre has been around for 5,000 plus years, since the Greeks threw on a toga and a bearskin and started running around doing their stuff. And that stands the test of time. It's just, it's more of a purist's kind of art form of pursuit. But it thrives. And maybe that's just what's going to happen, is that films will be made for the theatre, and that they, you know, I know if there's a Paul Thomas Anderson film comes along, I'm going to want to go see it in the theatre. If there's a James Cameron film that comes along, I'm going to want to go see it in the theatre. Sure, I can stream it probably day and date. That happens. But many people choose that option. It doesn't negate it. But for those of us who are like, want that theatre experience, you know, it's interesting because like horror films seem to do really well in theatre, because there's something about the collective of all being scared together at the same time that really draws people in. And I think it'll just hopefully go through waves and changes. And for some people streaming, maybe there's stuff that they would never ordinarily watch that it gives them access to, that, you know, because it's an effort going to the cinema. But some people go, I'd never go and see Wicked, but then I've streaming, clicked, I watched it, I saw Wicked, it was really good.
That's
sort of, I think railing against it is sort of, I don't know, it's kind of shouting against the wind, isn't it? It's like, okay, what's the difference?
It is what it is.
Is, and if there's revenue being made, then forget it, you know, you might as well go with it rather than try to fight. But there'll always be the purists. Well, as soon as Quentin does another film, you know, we'll all be buying a ticket, you know, there's your man. Exactly.
So, But yeah, I mean, I'm definitely not one of those that goes to the cinema when there's a horror film. I want to control my environment. I want to control how bright the room is, how loud the television is.
I'm with you. Yeah, I'm with you. I don't want to. Yeah, I don't want to go and see Get Out at the cinema. Like,
You know what? With Get Out, I had the worst experience. I was living in New York at the time, and I went to go and see it with a friend of mine on Times Square. Now, the majority of the audience, I would have said probably 95%, they were African American. It became an interactive experience. They were yelling out. They were in dialogue with the characters. And you can't trust that bitch. What the fuck did she say? And it got to a point where I had to get up and leave because I was, I was so taken out of it.
I'm trying to watch this film and please be quiet. Right, thank you very much. Right. No, but I've had those experiences around the world. I remember going to Trinidad and Tobago with a mate of mine years ago. We went to Trini. And what did we go and see? It was like an action film. I can't remember what it was, but literally there were people shooting guns and not in the audience. and people diving under the seats in front of us and screaming out and shouting. It's like a much more kind of interactive experience. But also I've had the same thing in India as well. You go to India and there's like you go and see a great Bollywood musical. Everyone's up and dancing and singing along and moving around and chatting and walking about and buying food. And it's sort of, you know, but they can be very long, those films as well, the Bollywood films. Sort of, they're ready for long stories to be told. But it's very different from, would you mind turning off your phone, please? please don't talk. I'm trying to listen to Arnold shoot these people, you know, or whatever it is. That,
exactly.
Know,
it's more of a cultural thing.
Yeah. I think so. I mean, it can be, I think if you're not ready for it, that's can be a bit.
Do you have a top five?
Top five theatres, cinemas.
A top five movies, your favorite movies.
How could you answer what your top five movies are? I mean, everyone says it's like on a day-to-day basis. It's like, you know,
changes,
I love Old
right.
Boy. I love Old Boy. But, you know, I just saw a Grand Theft Hamlet and I kind of enjoyed that. But
is that the one that's all on the video game? Like,
yeah,
Twitch?
On Grand Theft Auto. Yeah. It's kind of interesting. It's just interesting because that's the thing, you know, films sort of evolve and different new people come into play and new ideas and the visions come forward and voices, and that's always interesting. I watched My Old Arse, I watched the other day, with Aubrey Plaza.
Oh, right.
And,
yeah, I've heard good things.
And amazing stuff. It's great. It's a great little film. And you're like, okay, they probably made that for nothing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like, Margot Robbie's the producer and her husband. You know, it's sort of like, it's got this pedigree, but it's a really sweet, smart little film. But yeah, okay. So you're Singing in the Rain, I would say, is up there for me.
God, yes.
And and Old Boy is definitely up there. There Will Be Blood is definitely in there. Probably if it was on, I'd watch it. And Boogie Nights, I think, you know, I have two Paul Thomas Andersons in there.
That's a blind spot for me.
Yeah, really. Good, Bad, and the Ugly will probably be, or The Wild Bunch. I mean, you know, it's like. It's tricky. But then I'd even have The Incredibles in there because I just love the pure exuberance and kind of undiluted fucking fun of that.
Yeah.
And Brad Bird, you know, he's just a brilliant filmmaker.
Agreed.
It's a really hard, difficult, hard thing to call.
When you when you watch these films, do you like when you're watching them? Do you end up thinking of them like in terms of your own craft, or is it you just try and experience it as an audience
member?
I
think Alien would be definitely in my top five. I think I'd have to go, but I think I just experience them as an audience member. I mean, look, you can go back and revisit it and go, okay, what was going on here?
Yeah.
Or I'm sometimes aware of like, oh, I'm watching really accomplished camera work and really good vision, and someone's worked really hard at putting this together. But I think that might be sometimes like when you're watching a really bad film, you go, God, this camera work's terrible, the editing's bad, or the acting's bad. You're not in the story, you're not in the thing. And if it's really good, you can go back and dissect those things. But I think for the first time round, I want to be like, did I just watch Kung Fu Hustle and just go, my mind has been blown. And I want to go back and look at it. But okay, he's fucking brilliant, you know. And then go afterwards, oh, I should watch that again, because there's obviously I enjoyed something so much that you know, I got to go back. So, yeah, it's difficult. I'm not that massively analytical. I'm the instinct guy, and I use all of that to bring all of that to bear, I think, when I direct, because I think there's a gap in my technical game, because I'm not a very technical actor. When I was an actor, I would learn my lines and kind of act my way through it rather than having to, you know, I mean. But you can't get away with that so much with directing. You've got to. But I recently sat and rewatched Alien and was like, oh God, there's some incredible choices being made here. And how do I start leaning into that really genius idea, that vision? Because I do think a lot of things feel generic now. I think maybe, you know, you asked about streaming. I don't know if it's a sickness of streaming. I just think it's the choices now that I get to make. You kind of have to make generic, safe choices. And so when things like, I don't know, Grand Budapest Hotel pop out, you feel like, oh, we're in the director's vision. There's a voice here. And obviously with Wes, that's the case. But new ones. I suppose the bad example would be as I watched Alien Romulus and felt, oh, they missed a trick here, because if it's not like the original. The original, you know, people are out of focus when they're speaking, or it's the camera's on somebody else, or it doesn't cut away to a wide. You know, with the traditional stuff, you go, okay, two shot, wide, you know, close up, blah, 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 let's get it in the edit. And the new Romulus just felt so sort of smooth and kind of uninspired in terms of what Ridley was doing back then in the day.
That's so interesting. Yeah, I did you ever hear this story? And I listen to a lot of movie podcasts, but it was about James Cameron pitching Aliens. And apparently, we don't know if this is true or a rumor, but it's a great fucking story. And he's in the room with all the studio executives and all, and he just stood up and he went to this whiteboard and pitching the sequel to Alien, he wrote Aliens, and then he made the S a dollar sign.
Oh, well, that. I can believe that.
Right.
That was probably some canny exec after. Yeah, I've heard it that he had Alien written up and then he put the S. I've never, it's a great story. I've never been in a pitch where they would go, oh, okay, that's enough for me. And they'd be like, yeah, okay. Mm-hmm. What happens? You know, but yeah. I mean, but what had he done before Aliens that gave him the right to do? Oh, Terminator.
It was Terminator. Yeah.
I suppose, yeah, that would give him a lot of clout in the room. That would give him a lot of, you know, because that film came out of nowhere, for not very much money and made a hell of a lot of money. So he would have definitely been in a position they'd be like, great. They would just be happy to have him in the room. And
yeah,
he could get away with not giving away very much. But that's not my experience yet where you can just go, hey.
Make an S a dollar sign. Yeah, exactly. That's all it takes.
Just leave the rest to me. How much do you need? It's going to be upwards of 100 million. But anyway, I mean, look, he's a visionary. You know, he is. He's like, there's no two ways about it. It's, and to make, you know, a sequel that's arguably as good as.
Oh, I mean, you know, especially for me growing up in the 90s, Terminator 2 was like, that's the one.
Yeah. When I go back and look at them now, though, I still, maybe that's my, when I grew up and I went to that cinema and watched Terminator. That for me is the one, you know. I get Terminator 2, and I remember seeing that in the theater as well, in the ArcLight on Sunset in LA. When I'd literally just arrived in LA, touched down, I was like, let's go to the cinema and see Terminator 2. It was amazing. But Terminator, the first Terminator, is just staggeringly good.
Yeah, and it's something to do with how incredible film scoring can be, because that's simple. Those notes of boom, 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 just filled you with such dread. You know, it's an incredible harbinger of the title character's coming, you know. Amazing.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, the other one I remember going to see was The Thing as well.
Oh, incredible.
And They Live as well. You ever see They Live?
I never saw They Live, no.
Yeah. It's pretty special, that is. Yeah.
I mean,
you know, they just let some real mavericks make films back then, you know, real crazy guys. Because they didn't need much then, you know, they could make a film for 20 plus and they'd just be brilliant.
Make loads of money. Interestingly, about The Thing, I read the other day that Morricone's score for The Thing ended up with a Razzie when it first came out, which just seems so absurd now because it's such a classic. But
But that's Shawshank's like that as well, isn't it? Apparently, be like, "What's this rubbish?" You know, people were saying about.
And then in time, a whole new appreciation. How do you feel about movie scores, Dexter? Because that is actually probably all I listen to. Actually.
Oh, really? I listen to scores. I love them, and they move me, and I know they connect you to that storytelling. I mean, look, the great thing about a score is you put it on and as you walk around, you're suddenly in your own movie. And there's nothing wrong with that feeling because otherwise because you're the lead. It's all about you.
Yeah.
And the gym's quite boring otherwise. Something I feel is I got to learn more about and want to learn more about as I develop, you know, and you get to work with different artists and that's always very exciting. And you see how integral it is. And you know, when you come from my background, you just like tend to want to put needle drop on all the time. And
right.
You're like, yeah, that's really expensive. And you can't just do that. You need someone who's an expert kind of helping you tell your story and guide it through. I mean, look, I love a great score, and Morricone is fantastic for me.
Oh, he's one of my faves, yeah. That's actually how me and Luke bonded. Yep. We met working front of house at the National History Museum. Yeah. And we just got to talking about movies. And then Luke, you mentioned that your favourite score was...
Taxi Driver.
Bernard Herrmann's Taxi Driver.
Yeah.
And
yeah, that is great.
Yeah.
Good call. And I was like, who's this guy? And then I turned to him and I went... Do you know who Ennio Morricone went? He went, of course. I was like, okay, I like you. I like you. Yeah, it's funny because Lorne Balfe, who scored Ghosted, and I was watching, as soon as I was watching Ghosted, that opening scene, you've got the establishing shot of the car driving Ana de Armas' character. You hear the score there. I immediately went, hang on a second. As soon as I heard it, looked him up. When I saw Lorne Balfe, I was like, makes sense. Lovely themes, lovely moments.
Yeah,
I saw Lorne Balfe just a few weeks ago at the Royal Albert Hall. He was doing Top Gun Maverick in concert. He was conducting it live.
I was there too. Anyway,
you were?
Go on. I was. Yeah, go on.
I maintain that is one of the best scores of the last 5 years. Incredible.
Maybe you should get him on your podcast.
Please, that would be incredible.
I'll ask him for you.
Oh, thank you, sir. That would be incredible.
Yeah. He's a lovely man. He's a really generous, lovely soul, Lorne. And he's brilliant at what he does as well. You know, worked with Zimmer for all those years. And obviously there's a lot of good provenance in that. And he's talented in his own right. And but that's what someone who's brilliant like Lorne, I'd not worked with him before, will come in and do and just elevate it. And I didn't make it easy for him. You know, it's a kind of unforgiving score because, you know, someone can come with a whole suite of stuff and you're like, yeah, no, I don't like it. And, you know, they sort of, because you're off in your bubble editing and you're saying, I want something that sort of, it's just going to lift this, but not to be too obvious. And, you know, it's like a really spurious kind of remit that you give them, I think. And it's got to be simple, but I really want to be elevated. You know, you're using all these kind of phrases that that are sort of contradictory completely in their nature. And someone like Lorne's go, no, I get you. And, right. and they disappear.
And try and figure that out. Yeah.
Yeah. And then you're never happy. You know, I don't know. I mean, I'm sure he's constantly up against people going, because it feels like they can just go away and do it again. Which I'm sure, you know, cooking it up is not, easy. And then you are playing some weird, obscure reference. What was I playing him? It was really obscure reference. Lewis Cole. There's a guy called Lewis Cole. Oh, God, what was that fucking track called? And he was like, looking at me like, wow, this is really weird. Oh, God, I want to remember what that track's called. It was really unfair of me to do it to him. Louis, I think that was his name. What was his name? Fucking hell. He's a really weird bloke. This is him. Oh, I'm Tight. This is what I played it. I'm playing it.
I'm Tight.
I'm Tight. I'm sure that's what it's called. Yeah.
We'll pull that up.
Yeah, it's called I'm Tight by Louis Cole.
Louis Cole. Okay.
Yeah, I'm playing it to myself right now. Yeah, it's called Louis Cole. I'm Tight. And I just remember him looking at me like, okay, right. And it's got a really funny video to it as well. And I'd be just in his come down to his studio and put it on and fucking piss myself laughing. And it's like this guy dancing with these strange girls.
What I mean now?
Yeah, yeah. Anyway, I'm going off on a tangent. I'm just trying to explain those, like, you know, the randomness of what an artist will bring another artist in order to try and reference something that doesn't seem connective at all. But he's very, very patient. And he gives really good whiskey at Christmas as well.
Oh, excellent.
As a gift, yeah.
That helps.
He's a Scotsman.
That helps, yeah.
Just sticking on scores for a moment. When working on a film, do you have to sort of like think about them differently when it's on a film like Rocket Man or Bohemian Rhapsody, which is like already a musical in itself?
Yes. I mean, look, you always get temp stuff in. I mean, that's the thing, you know, in the edit, this is another great, you know, bane of the composer's life, is that even with Rocket Man, we know we've got these big numbers and you know how they sound, and you can rearrange them. You get different arrangements of them, so they're doing different things from what the original artist did, what Elton did with them, or not so much with Bohemian Rhapsody, because Bohemian Rhapsody is not a musical as such. It is just a story with the songs in it. Whereas Rocket Man is a musical more in the purest sense of the word, because it takes the source music and uses it really in storytelling terms, much more directly. But what you always do is you put together an edit and you put temp score on. You go, oh, look, there's a bit of... I remember my first film I did, Wild Bill, was using a lot of Michael Collins and Bubba Hotep, right? And just put that on as temp stuff. And Bubba Hotep's all like, have you seen Bubba Hotep's like about this guy living?
No.
Oh, Bubba Hotep's a great film. You've got to see.
I've heard of it.
This guy, like, you know, he ends up living in this old people's home, and Elvis is there. And who's that great fucking horror actor?
Lon Chaney?
What's his name? Campbell. Anyway.
Joseph Campbell?
No, not Joseph Campbell. No. Bubba Hotep, and it's a really good film, but it's got like really twangy guitar music in it, and it's like Elvis is still alive and he's living in this retirement home in the middle of nowhere, and there's all like these vampires and monsters attacking this old people's home. It's a really cool kind of niche.
Bruce Campbell. Yes, we so me and Luke, we're part of a film club that we started back in the pandemic, and it's only grown and it's international. It's amazing. We get to watch films all the time. One of the members in it mentioned this film not so long ago and said, you have to watch it.
Yeah, it's a great film. It's a great, great film. But the score's really good. So anyway, we used a lot of that. And then Michael Collins as well, the Clooney film. It's really great. Not Michael Collins? Yeah.
Oh, yes. Michael Clayton.
Clayton. Michael Collins is the film with Liam Neeson. Michael Clayton is the film I'm thinking of. Right, anyway. So anyway, look, what you do is you put a lot of temp score in, and you get kind of attached to it because it starts doing, you edit to it almost. You know, you sort of get the synergy between that piece of music and that mood and that feel, and then you're always editing's an ongoing process, a frame here, a scene there, a word there, whatever it is, and you know, they become sort of symbiotic, as it were, and then the composer has to come along and throw away the temp stuff that you've become absolutely in love with, and then try to do something that's completely original but feels like that, and you go, I don't know, it just doesn't have the same feel. And they're like, oh, for fuck's sake, why did they put any temp on it? That's so in tough, ideal yeah. world, you know what yeah. you want to do is like, give me a suite of music, and a suite means give me one that's a fast version of it, the slow complicated version, the romantic version of it, the sad version of it, the, you know, the, all the different versions of this piece of music that we think we're going to use, and then I can use it as temp on certain parts of the film, and hopefully you're not a million miles away from where you want to be. But the original question is about Rocket Man. I was working a lot with Giles Martin, who produced all of the music for Rocket Man, and so he started drawing from the actual song Rocket Man, and that finds its way more into the score. But Bohemian Rhapsody, it's composed soundtrack on there in between their great songs. It's a tough one.
And I want to speak to this as well, because I only watched this very recently, but one of the earliest films that you appeared in was The Bounty from 1984. Mm-hmm. I only watched this a few months ago, randomly. I thought I'd never seen this version of it. I really enjoyed it. Cast is absolutely stacked. It's a murderer's row of talent. You've got Mel Gibson, Anthony Hopkins, Laurence Olivier, Daniel Day-Lewis, Liam Neeson, Dexter Fletcher. What was that experience like? Yeah. I can only imagine the amount of observation and learning that must have taken place for you.
Yes, there was certainly a lot of that. A lot of the observation was about how to behave badly, because it was an all-male cast on a small Tahitian island for 9-10 weeks, being paid per diems, lots of money, and not having a great deal of responsibility, and just having... I was 17, so I was young.
Jesus.
I walked out of the Phoenix and straight onto the aeroplane and went Tahiti, you know. We all became very tight. You know, there was a really good bunch of us. It was wild. It was really good fun, because it was this ensemble cast, and we spent a month in London first doing all the below deck stuff, like fights and storms and lots of, you know, scenes, the mutiny, the below deck bits of the mutiny we did with Hopkins. And I'd worked with Hopkins on a film called Elephant Man before that.
Of course.
And I was 14. And so I knew Tony, as I like to call him, from Elephant Man. And we worked for about a week doing all this below deck stuff. And it was Liam and Neil Morrissey and... Phil Martin Brown, and I remember all of these guys, and we're all there. And then Hopkins came on set the first day he came on, and it's the scene where he chews out Daniel Day-Lewis below decks, and he came on in his full fucking regalia and his full Captain Bligh gear, and he came on set, and everyone was like, whoa. And he saw me and went, hello, Dexter, how are you doing? All right, it's good to see you. Oh, lovely to see you. All right, Dexter. And I was like, this is great, because all the others just looked at me, and I was like, all right, Tony, how's it going? I was 17, I was the youngest. So I immediately...
You're in with the captain, yeah.
I was in with the captain. I was in with Tony Hopkins. He was saying hello to me, you know, asking me how I was, and that made me look really cool, which I loved. And he was always really lovely to me. But I was like, the little pain in the ass running around. I remember I just adored Liam Neeson. I just followed him around like a puppy, everywhere. You know, I must have drove the man completely mad, because we went then to Tahiti. You lived on an island, and I just followed him around, and he was like 30, 31. I just thought he was just the business. He was like, but you watch those people do great work. I had to do a scene where I had to cry, and I'd seen Tony Hopkins do it in Elephant Man, where he did this thing where he sees the Elephant Man for the first time, and he doesn't blink. And eventually your eyes water, you know, it kind of helps bring forward that emotion. So I did that, and everyone went, oh, that was great. And I was like, yeah, I learned it from Tony. You just don't blink. And he was like, don't give away the fucking secrets, man.
The secret.
I was like 17, so I was a bit stupid.
But a peek behind the curtain.
Yeah, but no, they were all very generous and lovely. And I think when we all see each other from time to time, which occasionally happens, as you do on these big jobs, there's a lot of affection, because you have really good memory. Even when I bumped into Mel Gibson again years later, I did a day's work on a film called The Patriot,
Amazing.
Which is a film that, and I was just, yeah, I was just, yeah. In, yeah, yeah, I was just in it for a day, and he came up to me and chatted to me like, yeah, he'd seen me just last week, you know, and I was like, oh, wow, Mel, haven't seen him for a long time. But that's kind of what happens on those things. You become like a little ensemble, you know, it's the same with a band of brothers, guys. We're all, you know, there's like a deep affection for each other, and you might not see each other for years, and it's always great when you do. It's like seeing old family, old mates.
You see, these stories are what I fascinating to hear, because you've had such an incredible career and you've worked alongside and directed the biggest names in show business. Have you ever thought about writing a memoir or commissioning someone to do so?
Oh, God. No, I haven't. I haven't, to be honest. I haven't. No, they did a thing at the BFI couple of years ago now. It was like my 50th year in the industry, because when I was six, I was in a road safety film with John Pertwee back in the early days. And then, I mean, look, like next year I'll be 59. That'll be 50 years since Bugsy Malone, which I was in. That's 50 years of that. I mean, I suppose it hasn't really crossed my mind, to be honest. I see that Pacino's just come out with one.
Sonny Boy, I can't wait.
Sonny Boy, yeah, me too. But he is 84, so maybe I'll wait another 25 years.
Exactly, yeah.
And if I'm still kicking about, then I'll go, maybe it's time I...
God willing.
You know, I want to make a few more films yet. I'm not quite 60 yet, and I think I've got a few more films in me, so I'd like to... see what else I get. I suppose it might happen at some point. Who's to say my wife has anything to do with it?
Absolutely, yeah. Are there any memoirs?
If it does, I'll do it at the Phoenix. I'll do readings of it at the Phoenix. Yeah.
You heard it here first, folks.
Chapter one.
Incredible. Yeah, do you have any memoirs or biographies of artists you admire that you have read and enjoyed?
I started getting the Brando's one when I was doing The Offer, and I was excited to read Al's as well. And Al Ruddy, the producer of The Offer. I'm trying to think if I remember reading the Errol Flynn one many years ago when I was young, and Niven's The Moon's a Balloon. They're fairly interesting. But the other one I read recently that I really love is Bob Mortimer's memoirs.
Oh, yeah.
So, I mean, like, it's not really a film memoir as such. It's not really the question you're asking. But no, is the shorter answer. I wonder if there's one on Kelly, Gene Kelly, I should dig out.
Oh, that would be incredible. Yeah. One of the best I ever read was the actor Ron Perlman's biography. Yeah. It's called Easy Street, The Hard Way. Mm. And I highly recommend it, Dexter. It's great. Mm. My favorite types of bios are ones that are frank and full of honesty. And it's not just about the major successes, but also the incredible lows, because I feel that's what the majority of people can relate to. I was... fortunate enough to meet Ron Perlman. So I used to work at the Harold Pinter Theater front of house, and he just stood in front of me one day ordering a drink. And I thought, fuck me, it's Ron Perlman. I've literally just finished his autobiography too. So I feel like I know the guy, you know what I mean? So anyway, I serve him his drink and I was like, Chris, just say something to him. Ah, fuck it. I'm just going to say something. So I said, Mr. Perlman, I read your book recently, and I, as an actor myself, I said, I just really appreciate it. It was really inspiring. And he said, oh, so it was you. He said, you were the only one. And I said, well, there you go. And he said, oh, thank you so much. And I said, look, these are on the house. And he went, oh, come on. And he tipped me £20. And I thought, you know what? That right there, that is so classy. And so that was so lovely to be able to just literally close the book on someone and then meet them in person. I was, you know, it felt, you do feel that connection with them. When I was training as an actor in New York, I read Michael Caine's autobiography. He's done a few books, but I believe it was called The Elephant to Hollywood. Another incredible one, because again, they're not afraid to talk about the lows, and that's what I feel endears you to them. So, as you said earlier, Al Pacino's book, I can't wait.
Yeah, and Al talks, you know, I mean, I'm lucky enough to know him. And so he talks very openly about, you know, those lows as well, and the times his battles with alcohol and what that meant to him, or the battles that he had while he's making The Godfather, you know, the self-doubt that he was racked with and what he was putting himself through just in terms of his self-belief, and that's, you know, the kind of actor's, you know, predisposition is kind of like, I so doubt myself that if I don't get out there and do something that it will swallow me whole. And so you have to kind of create these avenues of opportunity where you can challenge that self-doubt within yourself. And the only, you know, one of the great ways to do it is expose yourself in front of all these people, literally, you know, and you know, that's why there's incredible highs and lows with it. But even when it's going well, it doesn't mean to say you don't have those nights when you lay down and you go, fuck, what was I doing out there today? God, that was just shocking. But, you know, you kind of come to this level of understanding that when you push through all of that kind of stuff, that it kind of goes with the territory, and that all that stuff that you're feeling and thinking and trying not to watch yourself inside is the audience are not seeing it. They're taking on their journey and they're watching, they're perfectly happy. Every actor, no matter what other actors think of them, good or bad, has their massive fan base. You know, I might go, oh my God, I can't bear X, Y, Z. He's terrible or she's awful. They have millions of fans who love it. Yeah. And they probably have enough nights when they go, oh my God, I can't bear myself. What am I doing? I know I did as an actor. I'm like, God, I watch stuff I do. I go, God, I'm so bad in it. But when someone comes to you and go, fuck me, I really loved the Rachel Papers. It's a really great film. You're so good in it. You've got to take it. You've got to be like, yeah, okay, thank you very much. You know, it's so kind. Mm-hmm. And like, you know, and you could be self-deprecating about it, but no one wants to hear that. They don't want to hear you go, oh, I don't know, man, I didn't think it was my best. They'd be like, you've got to be like, great. And when you said to Ron Perlman, I've just read your book, and he was like, you're the only one, because, you know, yeah, sure, you write it, and you think, nobody bought it, nobody read that book. And then to meet someone randomly and go, I just finished your book, and it was fucking great. These are on the house. It's like, you've already given him more than those free drinks just by saying to him, I loved your book, I read it. That's why I gave you £20, because it's like, you just made his fucking week. And somebody read it. You know, and liked it or didn't like it or whatever, but they read it. So that alone is like a massive thing. So,
just jumping off kind of some of the points you're just making, how would you say you kind of view film criticism in general? Like, is it something that you pay attention to at all? Is it something that's like always in the back of your mind when you're working on films?
It's got better since Ghosted took an absolute drubbing from the critics, critically, you know, did not do well, was not well received. People were like, oh, we've seen it before, we know what it is, God, there's no chemistry, la la, yeah, yeah, yeah. Which I didn't see. I saw them working together and I thought they got on great. It felt like the film didn't get boring, which to me is the worst sin in the world on a film. You know, if I'm watching it, I'm like, I don't care if I've seen it before or the ideas are being read. If it's boring, that's far worse than being unoriginal in a way. Anyway, you know, and of course those things hurt and you carry them with you. But at the same time, you realize that it means just as little as it does as if like people are raving about it, because it's all transitory, you know, because the thing about Ghosted is that Apple, who platform it, love it because it's in their top 10. For the last 18 months, people watch it. That's what they want. They want a library of films that people want to watch. They enjoy it. They finish watching it. They have now streaming have completion rates. So many people turn things on. How many of them complete watching? In the cinema, it don't matter. You bought the ticket. You can buy the ticket, walk out 2 minutes later, you still paid what you're going to pay. And if you choose to bail, that's on you. But the TV, you could turn it off and you can go somewhere else. They don't want you to do that. So its completion rates are good. You know, we tested it. It scored 89%, which is kind of like, you know, in the top 5% of score, blah, blah, blah. I read those reviews the next day. I was like, oh, my God, I didn't realize it was shit. I thought it was good. And it is good. But
like you said, it's all subjective.
Yeah, it's all subjective, exactly. But you need to get to a place where you can realise that, because otherwise you're like, oh, my films are great. Oh, Eddie the Eagle scored 79 on Rotten Tomatoes. La, la, la. You know, okay, great. But now what? Now what are you going to do? What are you doing next?
Right.
You know, you've done that. So, do it again. Do it better or whatever. But so it's about, yeah, being subjective and kind of being able to brush it off. And you know, again, I'd rather have audience than good reviews.
Yeah.
No, 100%. it's great having good reviews. It is. I've had it, but no one's seen, very few people have seen Wild Bill. People in the industry saw it. It got me notices. But yeah, okay, you've seen it. Good,
back,
thank you.
Back in the day, I chose that in our film club, actually.
Oh,
the pairing,
oh,
the pairing was just
was?
Dexter Fletcher directed movies. So it was Wild Bill with Rocket Man.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Wow.
Yeah. It was a random decision. I was like, I'm going to put two Dexter Fletcher films together.
Okay. Wow, I appreciate that. You should have called me. I would have turned
Fast forward 4 years. Then I'll tell you about it. Well, listen, Dexter, this has been absolutely incredible. Luke, did you have one final?
So next week, me and Chris, we're going to be filming basically a roundup of 2024 episode. We're going to, you know, be talking about the films of the year that we loved, maybe the ones we didn't so much. But I guess before you go, we just want to know, are there any films you've seen recently from the last year that maybe resonated with you or you just like generally really, really enjoyed?
Well, like I mentioned My Old Arse, I really enjoyed that I saw recently. And I'm trying to think now what is something that I didn't particularly like, which there are those out there. But that seems unfair to say because, again, it's subjective. I don't want to just put a stink on something unnecessarily.
Just like films you love. Like, for example, me and Chris, just last week we went to see Inora, and we were taken aback.
I've seen it.
Have you seen it?
No, I haven't seen it.
Yeah.
Ooh. Okay. I wasn't crazy about The Room Next Door. If you're doing the films that weren't crazy, which is the Almodovar, although I loved
and the latest one,
yeah, but you know, it's still brilliant. I think it's obviously, you know, you can't knock for someone for directing in a different language. Even to contemplate doing that, I can't, you know, I can't order a sandwich in a different language, direct a film in a different language. So I kind of had to go, all right, maybe you've got to cut a bit of, you know,
a bit of slack,
I'm just racking my brains. I'm having one of those moments where you go, I can't think of it. I like Grand Theft Hamlet. I really enjoyed that. That was kind of nonsense and brilliant. I wasn't prepared for that question. Sorry.
No,
that's all right. Actually, I would, another one I'd recommend, Dexter, our episode just released today is the movie Small Things Like These, which is the Irish film directed by Tim Melantz, starring Cillian Murphy. Produced by Matt Damon and his company. Highly, highly recommend it. It's quiet, it's contemplative, it's powerful. And the Phoenix screened that not so long ago. I would, highly recommend that.
So. Thank you. I'll check that because I've got the BAFTA viewer now, which is great because I'm getting loads and loads of films coming. So I'm going to do a big catch up over Christmas. When does the Phoenix reopen?
I believe it's the 18th.
December. Okay.
And they're reopening with Conclave and It's a Wonderful Life, which is lovely for the festive season. Yeah,
very good. So there'll be two screens there now. Then,
yes, obviously. Yes,
phenomenal. And do things like do the late nights still go on? Do you have late nights on a Friday and Saturday? And no.
I don't think they do. Because
Friday nights was great. Yeah, I suppose you'd need to start. You literally there'd be one person there manning the ticket and concessions booth, and you'd just be in there. Yeah, feet up on the row in front, smoking spliffs, watching Tin Drum, going, "What the hell am I looking at?"
Yeah,
this is great. The Ritz. I think it was called The Ritz. That film. God, I should dig that. It was a really interesting film. They don't do the late nights, unfortunately. I kind of understand that, but the cinema itself is kind of thriving. Does it have a good, solid kind of regular base of people who want to see?
Yeah,
films.
Very much so. I mean,
another screen.
Warrant another screen. Yeah, we very regularly have Zaylin, who is the Phoenix manager today, come on this podcast and just join us for certain films that he really wants to discuss. And everything I hear from him, it sounds like it is thriving. But it's also very interesting to hear about, because he's the one selecting which films are being screened. And I love his selections because he does go for exactly what that ethos of what Phoenix cinema is, which is films that are outside of the box, off the beaten path. But I remember when I first went to the Phoenix cinema. Now, Dexter, full disclosure, I'm not from North London. I'm from West London. I'm from Ealing. So, but I chose the Phoenix as the podcast. So the first time I went to the Phoenix was this year. And the first film I saw was Poor Things there. And there were walkouts. Specifically that moment where Emma Stone's using an apple to masturbate. Walkouts. And I thought to myself, okay, so I love the fact that Zaylin is not afraid to program things that may be a little in your face, that may be a little on the edge. And so even with walkouts, it seems like it's doing really well. I mean, God willing.
Okay. Yeah. Wow. And do they do screenings and Q&As of stuff? And do they have artists come in and people
do
that sort of stuff? Okay. Like
They do that quite often. Yeah. I think very recently, Steve McQueen was there for his documentary he did. Oh. No, it was called Occupied City. And I think it's a documentary he did recently. He was there for a Q&A, which is incredible. Yeah. So it happens every now and then.
And the programming is... is the mainstream releases, or there's always space for, hey, we haven't seen this in the theatre for a long time. Like, you want to see, you know, Amir Kusturica's Black Cat, White Cat, which is an incredible film, you know, or Underground. Amir Kusturica's great. He didn't make my list of top five, but that's another film as a film. I'm just, you know, I'm being self-indulgent. It's like, hey, could you go to him and go, this is a really great film that a niche amount of people will know, but it's a fantastic film that needs to be projected. It needs to be seen on a big screen. And or is he doing like, okay, we've got to fill it. It's a business. You've got to, you know, let's get Conclave out there and Jumanji 17 and whatever's coming up.
Well, it's interesting, because it feels like he doesn't tend to go for the big blockbusters. And yet it does seem as if his hand is forced at times. So coming up, there will be Gladiator 2. But there is always a moment for... He programmed a film recently. It was a Turkish film called Dry...
About Dry Grasses.
Grasses. So there's always something thrown in there that I suppose is like the Tin Drum in a way, where it's, I haven't heard of this. And who, and that's usually the ones that we choose to talk about. So I think he's trying to meld the two. Yeah.
Great. Okay. And like you say, I suppose with the new screen as well, he might be able to do, you know, fill those more... obscure slots.
Absolutely.
Amazing. Okay.
Oh, well, Dexter, honestly, I cannot thank you enough for taking
nice
the time.
No worries.
Been a pleasure.
And
oh, sorry I was late.
No, not at all. Honestly, this is the validation episode, right, Luke? This is the episode that this film podcast gets a stamp of validity and credibility by your appearance on it. I mean, we're not a huge podcast. My mum listens to it.
Okay. What's your mum's name?
Louisa.
Hey, Louisa.
She's going to be thrilled. But it means a lot to us. Thank you, sir. You've gained two more devout fans.
I'll have a chat with Lorne Balfe for you as well.
That would be amazing.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much.
Congratulations. It's great.
Thank you, sir.
There was something else I was going to say, but I can't remember what. Oh, no, I'm going to see Nosferatu. That's what I'm off to go and do now. That's right.
Enjoy. Yes, enjoy.
Yeah, exactly.
All right.
I will
close out here. Thank you for listening, everybody. Special thanks to Phoenix Cinema. Our music is by Stefan Krieger, and our episodes are edited by Noah Anderson. Once again, a huge thank you to Dexter Fletcher. If you like this podcast, please share it. Spread the word far and wide. Like, rate, and subscribe. It can only help us grow and continue to keep doing this. And then after you've done all that, go and watch a movie at the Phoenix Cinema, and I'll see you there.